We went through the beginning of the Gemara. I think we were up to Omar Mar. Well, I think we got a little bit further than that, actually. But maybe we'll just go from the two dots again. So we sort of did that first piece of Gemara. We'll just go from the two dots, the Tana Rabbanon. So just a third of the way down, a quarter of the way down, on your Yudalad Amud Bet. Okay, everybody with me? So the Mishnah, just a reminder that the Mishnah had sort of used a lot of quite vague phrases, and the Gemara is now going to explain each one, going through each one. So we talked about Shum Kesef first, and now we're talking about Shava Kesef, the Tana Rabbanon Shava Kesef. Right, so what exactly does that mean? The Tana Rabbanon Shava Kesef, as they taught, Shava Kesef means Melamed, She'ein Beisdin Nizkokin, Ella Linechosim She'yesh Bohem Achrayis. That based in, when it comes to collecting, the court will only collect from Nechosim She'yesh Lohem Achrayis, literally means purchases or acquisitions, property basically, which has Achrayis, literally means a sort of a responsibility to it, right? The responsibility to it is linked to something already, and basically that's land. Land means, what does it mean? It's a responsibility. It means that basically when a person makes a loan or a person causes damage or whatever they might do, they know that that land is there, right? That land is not going anywhere, okay? Property, other property might be bought or sold or disappear, right? Money might disappear. You don't know exactly how much the person has or doesn't have, but you know the properties they have. That you know. So you know whether they're able to pay back, and that's why we call it Nechosim She'yesh Bohem Achrayis. And basically what it sounds like at this stage is that the court can only collect from land, right? Which is a bit of a strange thing. And we're going to try and figure this out on two planes. Number one, is that really what the words mean, right? Does Shava Kesef actually usually mean land? And from a second point of view, we're also going to try and figure out from a reality perspective, is that the truth? Is that when we say that when the Mishnah seems to say now that the court can only collect from Shava Kesef, and that means land, does that really mean that the court can only collect from land, right? That seems to contradict other things that we've seen in the past, and also just logically, it doesn't seem to fit with us. So that's where the Gemara is going to go. So we'll start with the linguistic point first of all. Okay, so the linguistic point is as follows. I didn't finish the sentence. So Shein based in his cock and Elal and Nechosim Sheyesh by Machrais, they can only get the value of the damages from land, from Nechosim Sheyesh by Machrais. Aval im kodam nizak v'tofas, but if the nizak, the damaged party, actually went ahead and grabbed on their own metaltalin, then based in govan lemehen, then the based in will pay back the damages from those, first of all. So if you basically, it doesn't literally mean grabbed, okay, or it could be you grabbed it where you shouldn't have done, but it means even if it just happens to be in your hand, okay. So you, let's say you legitimately borrowed someone's whatever it is, someone's watch, okay, and then they caused you damage, so that watch is the first place where in a sense where you'll say, okay, well I'll keep this, or you know, if this is the value, then that's a good place to start.
What does it mean the Beth Din will collect it?
The Beth Din means once you
already got it.
No, it means that, I think it means that they that's where the money's going to come from, meaning they're not going to force you to return it. That's what it means. Yeah, I think that's going to be used to settle the bill, basically, to settle the bill of damages.
So he can sell it himself.
Yeah, exactly. Correct. Exactly. Okay. But again, at this stage, we're going to have two challenges on this. Number one, is that really what the language means? When we say Shava Kesef, does that really mean only land? And if so, how so? And then after that, we're going to challenge whether that's really the limitation, whether that's actually true, that the Beis Din can only collect from land. Okay. Unless the Nizak, unless the damaged party has taken something themselves or has something in their hands already. Omar Mar. So Omar Mar is referring back to a previous statement that we've had. Shove kesef melamed she'ein based in. No, that's generally what Omar Mar means. Ein based in nizkokin el nechosim sheish behen achrayis. My mashma. Well, you know, how do you figure this out? What is implied by the, or where does the implication come from? Omar Rabba Bar Ula, Dover Hashove Lekol Kesef. The way you have to read it is when it says Shove Kesef, it means Dover Hashove Kol Kesef, something that can be worth any amount of money, right? Any money in the world, or, you know, a huge amount of money, ma'inihu, and what exactly does that refer to? Davar she'ein lo ono'a, something which is not subject to the penalty of ono'a. We did cover this last time, but again, I think it's good to start off with this. So, property is not subject to the penalty of ono'a. We mentioned last time, ono'a is overcharging or undercharging significantly, and generally speaking, land is not subject to that penalty. So whereas if I overcharge you for an item that I sell you by more than a sixth, then the transaction is nullified, that transaction is void, doesn't count, and you return the seller returns the money and the buyer returns the object, then whereas with land that is not the case. Okay, whereas with land that is not the case. And therefore, Dover Hashava Kol Kesef, in a sense, land can be worth any amount of money, right? Any amount of money in the world, because as we said, you know, if the sale happens, then the sale happens, and that's set. So I want to come back to Onoa just to I think we might have mentioned them last time, but just to clarify a few elements about Onoa. But let's just finish off this bit before we do that. So the first thing is that the Gemara continues and says avodim ishtaras nami, right? Avodim and contracts, right, can also be and also not subject to the penalty of onar, ein lahem onar. So maybe they should be able to be claimed in this case. Ela omar rabba bar ula dover hanikne bekesef, something which is bought, literally means bought with money, right? The point is, that you have to. There are limited ways in which you can acquire property, more limited ways. Whereas with metaltalin, with other types of property, not property in that sense, but other types of objects, you can acquire them without the same sort of transactions or in a broader way. So, for instance, just picking it up or taking it or using it, you know, all those sorts of things would be ways that you acquire it. With regards to land, is more limited in the way that you can buy it. So again, the Gemara asks the same question, right? The same thing would apply to avodim and contracts as well. Ela omar of ashi shove kesef velo kesef v'hani kulhu kesef ninhu. So we settle on the reason why shove kesef is leading us in the direction of land over here is because it's something which is valued, you know, it has monetary value, but it's not considered kesef itself, whereas objects, other things are considered kesef, at least in this context. I think I mentioned at the end last time, I was a little bit puzzled that other things are not really considered to be kesef in other contexts. But I think in this context, the point is kesef means something which can be moved easily, right? It can be transferred easily. If you're moving, you can take objects with you. Unfortunately, we've got a lot of obviously displaced people at the moment, right? So when you take objects with you, you can take valuable things with you. You can take your money. You can take your cash. You know, you can take whatever you have. I don't know, gold bars, watches, or laptops, or whatever you want to take. You can't take your house. That's the one thing you're never going to be able to take with you. That's always going to be disappeared. And therefore, at least in this context, referring to kesef is money is a bit more fluid, and therefore that falls into the more fluid category, whereas land falls into the sort of more set category, and therefore but it still has monetary value, and therefore that is considered to be shoveh kesef, and that's what the Mishnah means. Okay, so at least from a linguistic point of view, we've sorted it out. We've still not sorted out whether it's the truth or not, whether that's the reality, but from a linguistic point of view, we've figured that out. So just a little word on ono, because I don't think we saw this. Yeah, we didn't see this inside. So there's a very short Tosfos over here, right at the end of the, right, basically matching up to the last lines of the Gemara. So just across, it begins with the word Dovar Hashaveh. The words Dovar Hashaveh. It's the second Tosfos on the Daf. Basically, the first one's very long, and the second one down. Begins Dover Hashava Kol Kesef, right? So as we said, Dover Hashava Kol Kesef was referring to land because it's worth any amount of money because it's not subject to the penalty of Onoa. So Tosfos very quickly jumps in here and says, Lav Dafka, it doesn't mean literally any amount of money. He says, De Yeser Mipalga Yesh Lahem Onoa. So Tosfos is of the opinion that if you overcharge by more than double, right, or undercharged by half, let's say, you know, whatever it is. The point is more than half the amount, or more than double, or less than half. Then Yesh lam onah, then it is subject to the penalty of onah. So land, you can't, although it's not, usually we have the amount of a sixth, right? But Tosas over here is saying, okay, well, we're still going to put the brakes on it a little bit, and you're going to go a little bit over that. Kidemashma perek hazav, he has a proof from a different Gemara. Gemara Mova Metzia, hazav is the fourth perek of Bava Metzia, if I remember correctly. So he has a proof from the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Ela Shavak Kol Kesef Yoser Mimetaltali. So that's his proof from there. But the truth is, the reason why Tosas is commenting over here, because this Gemara very much sounds like it goes against Tosas, and actually other Rishonim disagree with Tosas. Others say, so for instance, the Rambam, and I think possibly the Rosh as well, disagree and say that there is literally no the Rif, I think, also disagrees. I have over here. So others disagree and say basically that there is no limit to Onoa. There is no such thing as Onoa in when it comes to land. When it comes to land. Interestingly, and actually let's see if I have the language over here. When we say there's no ono'o, right, two things to point out. So the first one is, as we said, when we say no ono'o by land, we've just said that according to Tosas, it doesn't mean literally no ono'o, it just means it's got a higher, much higher bar set than normal. But the second thing is, and the Ramban says this, and I haven't seen anyone who disagrees with it, so I'm assuming everybody's going to go for this. The Ramban says that this is talking about the actual voiding of a sale, right? In terms of onor not applying to land and only applying over a sixth, that's only in terms of the sale becoming void. But in terms of the prohibition of doing it, he says that prohibition applies any time you knowingly overcharge or undercharge someone for any amount. Okay, if you intentionally overcharge or undercharge, says the Ramban, that prohibition applies regardless of whether the sort of, you know, the technicalities of whether the sale is going to be void or not. Yes, with regards to land, it's not going to come back over a or under a certain amount, but you're still prohibited. You're still not supposed to do that, and that's not. This is not like a sort of carte blanche to go and overcharge, as long as it's not within the not within that exact amount.
If you overcharge, you can perfect it by paying back the damages, right?
You can pay, for some things you can, but it's only very specific. There's very limited cases where that's the case. Yeah, the only time where we officially say that the sale stands, but the money goes back, is when it's exactly a sixth. But that's very hard to. I think it's very hard to sort of do that exactly, right? Whereas if it's less than that, then the sale stands and the money stands. Again, if you intentionally did it, it was prohibition, but everything still stands. And if it's over a sixth, then the whole sale is void. So it's a very specific case where you end up actually returning the money or returning the overcharged amount. Yeah. Fine. Okay, so that was a little word about Ono'o, and a little word about Ono'o. Okay. And again, there is an interesting debate. You could, if we had longer, maybe we'd sort of look into the details of Ono'o, but there is an interesting debate as to why land is excluded from Ono'o, and to what extent it's a sort of, to what extent there's a logic to it, or to what extent there's a logic that we, you know, that we understand, or sort of it links to. So, for instance, some say that the reason why Onor doesn't apply to land, I think, is because, for similar reasons that we've said in the past, right? The fact that in a sense, you know, it's linked to the right location, right? It's not the value of the house itself. It's obviously totally inflated or deflated, depending on where it is. And therefore, that's why Onoa doesn't apply. Others say it's simply what we call a Gezerat HaKatuv, right? A Gezerat HaKatuv means that it's just simply, you know, that's the, we learn it out from Psukim, and therefore that's the sort of declaration that the Torah gives, the exception to the rule, and that's why we would follow it. And therefore, potentially, if that's the case, then you're a little bit more wary to sort of put limits on it if it's just simply what the Torah says. Okay. It's quite warm, no? Excuse me? No. I feel like we've still got the heating on in here for some reason.
Okay.
Oh.
Alright. We assume that land here means
agricultural land, just agricultural land.
No, I think it means properties as well.
Any property?
Yeah.
Including property of the city.
That's a good question.
Because one argument could be that land in any event has only got a value of sort of 49, 50 years, and it's a diminishing value depending on where
That's only specific types of land. There are different types of land. There's what's called a Sdeh Achuza and a... What's the other one? Sdeh Achuza and a Sdeh... can't actually remember what the reverse is, but not every piece of land is subject to that.
Walled city properties are not subject to that, are they?
Right.
It's got to be agricultural land.
Yeah, but it's not just agricultural land. I don't think so, unless I'm mistaken. I think it just depends how the sale is done and to what extent. Often you can prove that it does go back in your family.
The value is always linked to...
But yeah, it's more of a lease. Yeah, it's more of a lease than it is a sale.
So it was more difficult to... I mean, depending on the fluctuating market price of the commodities that were grown.
Right.
But it's more difficult for there to be a... I mean, it's a... The land values would have been reasonably stable.
Because of the short space of time?
Yes.
Well, that'd be known.
Possibly. I mean, I don't know, 50 years is a long time. Yeah, you mean depending on how close you are.
And also depending on the quality of the harvest, I mean, and the rains. So, if you don't get much rain, there won't be so much rain, so the price of grain will go up.
Right.
So there will be some fluctuation, I suppose.
What's that got to do with the land itself? The land value, if you know, irrespective of the value of the crops growing on, surely.
Yeah, land value is going to be linked to all of those things, but I don't think this is about, you know, how much or how little it's worth. I think the point is that it's just more. There's multiple elements here. Each point in the Gemara was suggesting a different reason almost. So the final one, Rav Ashi's sort of final answer is basically Shava Kesef just means you can't move it, right? Which is true regardless of whether how close you are to Yovel or not. The point is it's less fluid than the rest. Right? Oh, but you're talking about Onoa specifically, why Onoa doesn't apply. So Onoa not applying, again, maybe it's just fall back on the Gezeiras HaKosev, as we said before, the fact that it's simply what the Torah says. Or how it works, I don't know, we'd have to look into the Rashbam, I think, is the one who sort of suggests this reasoning for it. He says, "Lakarka in Onoa, lefisha lakarka in mechir." There is no proper price for land. "Valakach shashilim kesef rav avur sade zu zu hi mechir hasade avura." Yeah, he says that basically when you pay an amount for land, then that is its price. If you're willing to pay that, then you're willing to pay that. So we'd have to look into that. It's interesting how that fits with Yovel and that sort of thing. Okay.
But surely that's even less certain. If we're saying that land price is known.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. But now we're saying actually it don't. It's what it's worth, what someone is prepared to pay for it.
Right.
So surely then it's more certain to have a monetary value of the debt rather than tie it to the land value.
No. Sorry, the value of you're talking about the amount that's owed.
Yeah, but we're just saying that land is only worth what someone's prepared to pay for it.
Right.
Whereas if there is a monetary debt, quantifiable debt owed, rather than pay for it in land. Money.
We're going to come back to whether you do that or not, but again, but the point is, well, we haven't got to whether you pay for it in land or not. So let's come back to that point when we actually address how you are paying for that.
If you can't determine the true value of the land because it has no value except that which one prepares to pay for it.
Yeah, although again, you still have some value to it. Meaning,
we'll have some value, but again, it's an unknown value until such time it's liberated.
In fact, if
yeah, but I'm not sure.
Number against those people, there's a value.
I'm not sure that affects what we're saying here. Again, the point over here is until this point, all we've clarified is that is why the Mishnah, when it says Shavei Kesef, is referring to claiming back land. So let's go through whether we really claim back land or not, and then we'll try and go through some of those elements to whether that works or it doesn't work. Okay, so Romi Le Rav Yehuda, we're basically halfway down, almost exactly halfway down. Romi Le Rav Yehuda Bar Chinana Le Rav Huna Bereita Rav Yeshua. So he says that we have a little bit of a contradiction over here, okay? Because very good, we've just said that that based in claims back with land, but we've said Bereita Rav Yeshua Tona Shava Kesef Melamet Shein based in Niskakin Elal Nchosim Sheish Lehen Achrayis. Great, we've just taught that, right? That based in is going to have to claim from land, but Vahatanya, and we've seen this Brisa. We've seen this in the past. The Brisa, we had another Brisa that says Yoshiv, that learns from the word Yoshiv. You have to return, you have to give back the damages. Lerabos Shove Kesef, to include anything of monetary value. Va'afilu Subin, we said even the barley, even the worst sort of types of grain, right? You can pay back from anything, basically. Any sort of any objects that you may own can be paid back, and again, cash as well, right? Any money, any type of thing. So why do we seem to limit over here the fact that Beis Din can only claim back from land? Ela hacha b'may askinan. Rather, this is what it must mean. We're dealing with a very specific case. B'yasmi. We're dealing with a case of yisomim of inheritors, basically. Okay, inheritors means that that they're dealing with debt from a deceased parent, right? Deceased parent or deceased relative, let's say. But keep it simple to say they're dealing with debt from a deceased parent, and therefore, in that case, you can only claim back from land. Okay, you can't claim back from objects. You can only claim back in that particular case from land. The Beis Din can only take it. But then we say, okay, if that's the case, so Amos Sefer, right? The end says that seems to clash with the second half. The second half said, "Im kodam nizak v'tofas metaltalin Beis Din govin lamehen." So the second half said that if the damaged party had, you know, had sort of taken something or had got something, then that can be claimed from. He said that's not true, right? That doesn't ibi yasme. Am I Beis Din govin lamehen? If we're dealing with the case of Yisomim, in the case of these inheritors, then why is the Beis Din, you know, upholding that? If I, let's say, for example, I have your, Reuven's father owes a debt to Shimon, and Shimon happens to have Reuven's, I don't know, he borrowed Reuven's car, for example, right? Borrowed Reuven's car. Reuven's father passes away. So Reuven says, okay, now I'm keeping the car, right? I'm keeping your car. He says, that's very nice. You can't do that. He said, that's my car. I didn't have a debt with you, right? That was my father's debt. And the halacha is that you can only take from the land in that particular case, right? From land that he had, that the shibud was created on, that specific thing was taken from. So that was in a sense linked already, right? So that responsibility was created earlier when the loan was taken. Kida Omar Rava, Omar of Nachman, Shetofas Mechayim. Maybe where he took it while the parent was alive, right? He took it while the parent was alive. So again, he took the father's car while the parent was still alive. So Hochonami Shetofas Mechayim. So to here, that's the case that we're dealing with. So really, we're dealing with this, as I said, a very, very specific case. We're dealing with when the Mishnah says Shavei Kesef, the Beis Din can only take from land. That only means where you're inheriting when you're inheriting a debt, right? And then they can only claim from inherited land. If they happen to have some of your parents' other properties, right, not property, but other objects or something else, then they can claim from those. But otherwise, it's only land that they can actually claim from, and not other things. So it leaves us a little bit unclear as to what Beis Din can take from or not take from. So the implication seems to be that you can take from everything. But in addition to the implication being that you can take from everything, unless I'm mistaken, should have brought a Rambam actually, but I think the Rambam says that the Rambam says that once this is the case, that actually that's what you should be doing. Okay, then in a sense, the first port of call is to take from cash, right, or something similar to that. And only if that doesn't work, then you take from land. So the implication over here is in a sense that this is the only case where this is really going to happen. But otherwise, land is going to be the last thing the Beis Din come to claim from, in a sense. It's only when there's nothing else that you're able to do. I think there's a thing in the back. Maybe not. No, I didn't have that. Okay. So the conclusion of the Gemara is in a sense almost the opposite of the implication that was given initially. Okay, the implication was that the Beis Din would only collect from land. Bottom line is, right, once the Gemara's pulled it together, the Mishnah was telling you is that's only in the specific case of inheritors, and in other cases, at least the way the Rambam's reading it, in other cases the ideal is going to be to take back from money and other type things beforehand. That's where you claim from, and only if there's a problem with getting that, then the land which is nechosim sheyesh lehem achrayis, which has this responsibility, you know, which carries a responsibility with it, then only in that sort of case will you end up claiming from there, or will they end up taking from there to settle the debt. Okay? Does that, I don't know if that helps with the, yeah, okay. Fine. Okay, so now we move on to the other elements of the Mishnah. So the Mishnah also said bifnei Beis Din. It has to be in front of a Beis Din. What does that mean, to have to be in front of a Beis Din? The Gemara says prat lemocher nechosov. Does this exclude someone who sells their property, right? Sells everything that they have. Va'achar kach holech leBeis Din. Right, so maybe he's got rid of everything. He doesn't have anything now. He says, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I'm skint, right? I don't have anything. And then he comes to Beis Din and says, I'm sorry, I don't have anything. So what can we do? And we turn them silent. And then... So... Yeah, well, indeed. I'm not sure we're using any of these as good models of what you should or shouldn't... Yeah, or shouldn't be doing. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Got to be careful who hears this recording now. We're going to end up with that, yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So if you say, I don't have anything left, right, I'm very sorry, I've got rid of it all, right, nothing to take over here, then you know, does that really work? So Shema Mino, what does the Gemara conclude? Lost it over here. Yes, Shema Mino, Lava Umochar Nechasav Va'achar Kach. But LeBeis Din, if you did that, if you let's say lent out or sold off all of your objects, everything that you had before you went to Beis Din, Ein Beis Din Govin Lo Mehen, can't is that really what the Mishnah is telling you? Ella, no, this is what the Mishnah is telling you. The Mishnah is telling you Prat LeBeis Din Hediotis. When it says Bifnei Beis Din, it's telling you that it has to be a real Beis Din. It can't be what we call a Beis Din Hediotis. Beis Din Hediotis is a very important concept in some areas of halacha, but when we're talking about over here, when you're going to be claiming, when we're talking about damages, payments, and other types of things, then you need to be going to what we call dayanim mumchim, right? Which means professional dayanim, right? Trained type. A Beis Din Shel Hadyotas is something we do use. Anyone know when we use a Beis Din Shel Hadyotas? We use it. Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that's the time where we use, just a regular Beis Din. Any three people, right, can become, can make a Beis Din. And that works in the area of, We do it before Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur if it's as a sort of a more general thing, but you can do it at any time to have a Beis Din there to annul vows. Okay, you make a makeshift Beis Din to annul vows. I've done that. Done that at a different time. There was a fellow who they don't even need to know the dayanim sometimes don't even need, as long as one dayan knows the details of the case, the other dayanim can in a sense can just say, I trust this one, calling them dying, this one person, right, this one person who is now on this based in Shel Hadyotas, and as long as we trust them, then all three of us are sort of coming together and we're gonna annul the vow together. So the case that I, wasn't a case, cases just makes it sound very very significant.
In the Book of Ruth.
Yes.
With Chalitza,
No, chalitza definitely requires based in
mumshim. It was the judges at the gate, I think.
Right. Yeah, but I think that no, that definitely chalitza definitely requires a formal bet. But annulling vows is the only example I can think of. I'm sure there are other things, but annulling vows is the classic example I can think of. As long as you get three people who technically could be a dayan, right? Whether or not they're trained is enough. So I had someone approach me. He tried to give up smoking, and he thought it would help him. There are people who do this. I've seen this done before. Very religious people. They say, "Well, you know, I find it so hard all week, but when it comes to Shabbos, I know that I can't, and then suddenly it's easy, right? It's easy because I know that the Torah says I can't. So what I'm going to do is basically I take a vow, a Torah vow that I'm not going to smoke anymore, and then now I know that the Torah says I can't smoke anymore. So in a sense, that sort of strengthens it, and that means it's much easier to give up smoking. So for some people that works, for other people it doesn't work. Some people suggest this for addictions. And as I said, for some people it works, for some people it doesn't work. The bottom line didn't work for him, so he wanted to annul. He wanted to annul that vow, but he was also embarrassed. He was also embarrassed to tell the other people. So he asked me to get a basin together, but not to tell them what it was. So again, that does work. It does work in halacha that you can have the other people on the bet din sort of take the word of one of the members of the bet din. And to see, as long as they see, what they have to see is the what we call the charota, right? The regret. The person definitely intends to annul that vow, to change what they've done, and in a sense, that's what you do. But you don't need a professional based in for that. But what our Mishnah is excluding that type of based in. Okay, when we're dealing with damages payments, you can't say we had a car crash, for example. You know, let's get the three people together. They're not going to be witnesses. We're just going to get everyone to sit down now, and they're going to be the based in, right? We're going to make a makeshift based in. They're going to decide what the payment is and what the all the details. So that doesn't work. That doesn't work if. Yes.
So if we're saying that the device doesn't work by saying, yes, I have this liability, but I sell the property, so I don't own it anymore, does that mean that the best thing can then go to the person who bought it innocently?
Well, it's not innocently. No, we've had this in the past.
No, knowing that if he buys it knowing that it wasn't attached, that the debt didn't attach to the land, then the best thing still go after the property.
But it does attach to the land. How would it not attach? Meaning, if it was any time the land is bought, that's the point. It's the responsibility of the buyer to make sure that this person doesn't have outstanding debts or anything like that.
Is that a defense?
If who doesn't know? The buyer doesn't know.
If a new buyer doesn't know, he's asked the question, and the guy who sold it is a right guy and says,
Yeah, defense is. Clean. I think defense is the wrong word. It's defense. Yes, it's a defense, but we're not. There's no accusation here, but it simply is not his, right? It's not his to sell. That's the point. It doesn't belong to him anymore.
It belongs to the creditor.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, that's the point. It has a link to that land. Right. The loan that was made, or the damages that were made, that's the point. Is when land is sold, that sort of stuff needs to be checked beforehand. Again, that's all. Unless I'm mistaken, I think that's always true. In any legal system, there's going to be a limit to you need to do background checks, right? Like you need to check, in a sense, what this person has or doesn't have, or what's going to come to a claim. And if you didn't do those checks, even if it was accidental, even if it was very innocent, I'd like understood, but there's not much you can do. Not much you can do as a result of that. There's nowhere to take from. Okay. Fine. Okay, so Pratla based in Hadiotis, as we said, that means that in this particular case you need a professional based in what we call Dayanim Mumchim. Should use the proper word. Dayanim Mumchim, expert Dayanim. Al Pi Edim. Okay, so it has to be with witnesses. So this is getting into actually very important principle, shas, what we call a shas principle. It happens across many, many Gemaras, this type of principle. But al pi edim, what does that exclude? Prat lemode biknas This is excluding what we call a moda b'knas. Moda b'knas basically means you admit in a case where you owed a penalty. So some payments are payments for simply paying back what you did, and sometimes you get a penalty payment over and above. So a classic example of that is what we call a ganav, right? A ganav as opposed to a guzlan. It's different types of theft. We'll use the simplest example. The simplest example is a ganav is basically someone who steals at night in a more surreptitious way. And in addition to paying back what they have stolen, a ganav has a double payment. A ganav has the expectation, the Torah sets on them, that they have to pay a penalty payment as well. So in addition to, let's say, giving back the item or giving back the value of the item, they need to then give back that value as a penalty payment. Okay? So the halacha is that although you do, there are certain things in which you have penalty payments, if you admit to your misdeed, right? If you voluntarily admit to your misdeed, then the penalty payment is reduced. So although you need to pay back what you stole, you don't need to pay back the double value. Okay, you don't need to pay back the extra over and above.
Is the extra to the victim or to the
Yeah, court? That's a good question, but I'm sure it goes to the victim. Oh, yeah, it means their lucky day, basically. Yeah. Yeah, victim. I'm pretty sure it goes to the victim. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, no court's not going to do it. I don't think that's a good system. You end up with the court. It's almost like the court's taking the money. I don't think that would work. I'm sure that's the case. Now you've got me thinking, but I'm sure it must go to the victim. Yeah. Yeah. And again, double is one thing. Sometimes you can get even more than that. I was going to say the Mishnah, but it's not the Mishnah. The Torah says that if you steal a sheep, for example, and you shecht that sheep, then you have to pay five times as much, I think, or four times as much. Now I forget which one it is. Tvacha four times as much or five times as much. I don't remember now. I have to look up the psukim, but it's four or five times. As an example, okay. So you can get a very large penalty payments, very significant penalty payments. But to come back to our Gemara over here, so prat lamoda b'knas. So over here we're excluding a moda b'knas, someone who admits what they did and therefore doesn't have to pay their penalty payments. Va'achar kach ba'u edim. But let's say you admit to it and then witnesses come forward afterwards. So there you might think that in a sense they knew that they were watched, they knew that they were seen, right? They knew that they were seen. Because they knew they were seen, that's why they're coming to admit. So maybe they shouldn't really get off the penalty payment, because moda b'knas va'achar kach ba'u edim, then witnesses show up, so then it looks a little bit more of a suspicious admission, right? It's not quite as doesn't feel like we were really encouraging the person to admit by giving them a break. Sounds like they were just doing it to sort of avoid the witnesses coming along. But yet, nevertheless, Shahu Potter, right? The point is over here, Al-Piedim is basically saying that it has to be with witnesses beforehand, and therefore Moda B'Kanas V'Achakach Bo'edim would still be exempt. Okay?
From the
additional amount, correct. B'Kanas, only in the Kanas, the penalty payment, exactly. Exactly. Okay. So Moda B'Kanas V'Achakach Bo'edim Shehu Potter Hanicha L'Mandam. This makes sense according to the person who says the Omar Moda B'Kanas V'Achakach Bo'edim Potter. So okay, that's subject to a debate, right? So that makes sense according to one, but according to the other opinion, that's clearly not what the Mishnah means, right? Elo Lamanda Omar, the second to last line, but according to the opinion that Moda B'Kanas, someone who admits and therefore thinks they're going to avoid the penalty payment, V'achakach Bo'u Edim, but then witnesses come along, Chayev, they are going to be liable, according to that opinion, Mai Ikar L'Memar. What is the Mishnah referring to according to them? That's clearly not what the Mishnah means. Sefer it's Derich Lei. So what it's basically Al Pi Edim is basically just sort of clarifying itself because of the later part, because of the second part, because we then continue. The Mishnah then continues and says Bnei Chorin uBnei Bris, right? Anyone who is free and Bnei Bris and Bnei Chorin l'mayote avadim. B'nai Choron comes to exclude Avodim, this type of servitude, right? That they would not be able to be a witness in this case. B'nai Bris, Lemiyote Ovdei Kechovim, in order to exclude idol worshippers, right? Potentially all non-Jews. But let's explain in just a moment. Utsricha. Let's finish off what the mission is saying. Utsricha, and the reason you need both of these, so we need to exclude both of these from being witnesses in these particular cases, right? In this in these types of damages cases, why? Because if we're only going to exclude an Eved Mishum De'in Lo Yachas, maybe the reason why we're excluding him is because he doesn't have any Yachas, no real relatives, okay? So when a person, again, according to Torah law, in terms of the servitude, doesn't have any legal relatives, right? Doesn't have any legal relatives, and basically ends up being a little bit on their own. I think this is a very fascinating concept, what you see about witnessing, but we'll flesh it out in just a minute. So the reason why they're being excluded from being a witness is because they lack that relationship with other people, and therefore that's maybe why they're excluded. But you might say that Aval Nochri, the Yesh Le'achas, they are part of that sort of contextual society and community and things like that. It's almost like they'll understand. I think the way I've understood the Gemara is that what it's saying is that in order to have a witness, in these types of cases, what you need to appreciate is what it means to in a sense to sort of function with other people, to sort of have the burden of other people, to feel that you're part of a society, part of a community, part of a family, that you want to be able to give to others, and in a sense because of, again, maybe even through no fault of their own, but because of the nature of this Eved's servitude, right? They don't have that sense. They're sort of very much on their own, and therefore don't have that sense of others in quite the same way, and therefore wouldn't be able to be a witness. But as the Gemara says, Aval Nochri Mishum Del, sorry, yeah, but Nochri would be Diyesh LeYachas. They do have that sense of community and other people and sort of togetherness and being able to support other people. So they do have that, and therefore maybe Eimo Lo, we might have thought that they would be able to function as witnesses. V'Iyash Meina Nochri, but if we would have had the opposite, if we would have just said the Nochri element, right, the those who are not B'nai Bris, part of the covenant, then Mishum Delo Shaykh B'mitzvahs, because they are not, they don't have that, again, burden of commandments and appreciating, in a sense, what it means to have a life focused on mitzvot. Aval Eved, but a servant, D'Shaykh B'mitzvahs, right, an indentured servant, I don't know if that's the right word, but certainly an Eved Kana'ani in the Torah is required to keep many, in fact most of the mitzvot, right? They do have to follow all of the rules, many of the rules, and therefore they do have that sense of, burden is the wrong word, but that sense of sort of that weight of responsibility, therefore they would potentially, you might have thought they could be a witness. Aval Eved D'Shaykh B'mitzvahs, Eima Lo, Tzricha, and therefore the Mishnah is basically excluding both. So what I think is very interesting here is that you see that in a sense, the idea of being a being an aid in this particular case, in these types of cases, being a witness requires a certain level of appreciating the severity. I think that's the way I see the Gemara over here. That in a sense, both of these things is lacking a sort of a sense of the severity of what the consequences are and what it means to be sort of presenting in this case, right? And in a sense, you can be you. What we're trying to avoid is people easily being bought off, basically. You know, people easily being bought off. That you would just say to the person, they don't really mind whether the person you know, lives or dies or pays or doesn't pay. In a sense, there's that lack of a sense of that, and so we have two elements here which are slightly lacking in that, both of them in their own way. One is a sense of community, which slightly lacks an appreciation of being part of, you know, part of society and part of a family and part of community and appreciating what it means to function with others. And the other one is a sense of mitzvot, of sort of living a life of commitment to higher ideals, living a life of commitment to something something more significant. And as I said, you know, in some small way, that also lacks a sense of a certain responsibility, a certain appreciation for that.
It seems a bit insidious. I mean, at the end of the day, it's up to the court to decide whether the witness is believable, credible. If all you're saying is that the witness witnessed with his senses a certain thing about which he's giving evidence,
right?
You know, to exclude a Gentile, to exclude a slave, who may be the only person who can tell the truth or put truthful facts before the court, seems to me totally prejudicial to justice, actually.
So there's an interesting. Which is, I'm not enough of an expert to go through the details, but I think we'd need to go through the details of witnesses. But my understanding is that there is a difference between being a witness in court. Is a particularly high level of trust, right? So it basically would override many other things. So in terms of giving, I guess maybe the word is maybe I think the challenge comes from, because we're talking about testimony, and we think of witnesses, let's say in a modern court, being, you know, that testimony is accepted. You can always trust. It doesn't mean that you throw out what the people say, right? Or you don't believe them, or you say, oh, because you're not a witness, then it doesn't count. You always have quote unquote non-kosher witnesses. Let's say you go to a Beis Din now, you always have people who are technically not kosher witnesses presenting in Beis Din all the time, and they listen to the story, they take it on board, and as you say, they judge whether they think it's the truth or not the truth. But it doesn't have that sense of creating a reality, which is a very, very high level of testimony. Okay, so for instance, you could have a case where two witnesses can sort of overcome, I don't know, can overcome many other seemingly contradictory factors, assuming they're kosher witnesses. Okay, so that's a very significant thing. Whereas the situations we're talking about, the testimony will be accepted, or as you say, evaluated, you know, taken on board as part of the sense of whether this did happen or didn't happen, or what, you know, what was the case or not. That's my understanding. But it doesn't carry the same weight to it. I don't think that's what it means. Yeah, it means legal witnesses in the sense of giving an official shtei edim testimony. You know, there's sort of this very, very strong testimony, which it basically equates to reality in halacha. If you have two legal witnesses who sort of with the official cross checks and things make a statement that is not contradicted by, let's say, two other witnesses, then that does become reality, in a sense, you know, a very, very significant reality. I think it was one other element that I wanted to throw in there. And then, oh yeah, this does link, and then we'll take out the questions on this. But it's not exactly the same type of witnessing. But I have this a little bit with witnessing, you know, weddings and things like that. Again, other times when we have witnesses, that there's this concept I get when we talk to a chatanakala. Sometimes a concept that anyone who keeps Shabbat can be a witness. So that's not really the case. It's not quite the threshold. It doesn't mean keep Shabbat. Keep Shabbat sometimes is a sign of something. But the point is that the person should appreciate the significance of what they're doing. So it means they should appreciate every element of Shulchan Aruch. You know, every little bit. They should appreciate that what we're witnessing over here is what you want to get a sense from when you're finding a witness, and sometimes this can be a little bit difficult, is that no matter what, in the same way that someone who keeps Shabbat, you could, you know, and genuinely keeps Shabbat, you could offer them £1 million, you know, or £2 million, and they're just, it doesn't make a difference to them because this is something that's very significant to them. You know, they know it's very deep to their core. So in the same way, when you would have if you would have someone who was getting pressures, for example, you know, to say that I don't know, to say that these people were married or weren't married, if you know that these people are people who would withstand that pressure, people who appreciate how severe this is, how significant this is, then that's really what you're looking for at its core. And there are lots of like signs, you know, there's lots of ways in which we do that, and there are technicalities, but the technicalities I think are based on that same thing. So I think that's the way I see this this Gemara as well, in a similar way, that what they're saying over here is that, for instance, to take the example of the Eved, that someone who is again, through no fault of their own, but the nature of their existence is that they have no, they're a little bit, I guess, loner is the wrong word, but they're sort of a little bit alone, right? Without legal family and without legal community or anything like that, they don't necessarily appreciate the importance of these relationships and of the damage that you can cause to other people and what that means to be part of that society. So therefore, that's going to be a significant lacking in their status as a witness. But
there's a lot of, I understand what you're saying.
Right.
But the cause and value judgment, some people appear to be okay, but they're not.
Well, then, but
I
they're
mean,
not.
You know, one of the things that always. That's the wrong way. That's why is it that from Arabia people steal?
Right.
And the answer is they'll steal, but now have done it. In other words, is that, you know, if a guy looks like from Arabia, you think he's okay, he could be a thief.
Right. Okay. So I'm glad that's not on the recording, but I want to clear something. I just so we can be clear. That's not a general statement. It does happen in the same way it happens in any other society. Yeah, but your point is, yeah, it looks kosher because.
That's right. What I'm saying is that the criteria that is being applied here is not necessarily be correct.
No, but you're saying that's like the reverse statement. You're saying because this is not the only criteria means. This is not the only thing. You know, we don't say that once you're not a servant and once you're Jewish, then fine, great. We don't bother looking at you or who you are or what you've done or anything like that. We don't do any background checks. That's not the case, right? The point is, you need, to be a witness is a very significant thing. For sure, we do check that. For sure, that's a very significant thing that's looked into.
Now, I'm talking about witnesses here. I'm not talking about witnesses for a while. I'm talking about.
Well, any witness. Okay, but witnesses here again, the same thing. A Beis Din for sure would check. Yeah, for sure would check who the witnesses are, and you would never accept testimony without all of those things. I think these are the ones that get thrown out because these are the less obvious ones, right? These are the ones that get. It's obvious that a witness who is suspected of theft is not going to be accepted as a witness. Okay? It doesn't matter what they wear, or what they look like, or how long their beard is, or whatever it might be. They're not going to be accepted as a witness in any way, shape, or form.
Is it still the case today that Beis Din would not accept as a witness a high court judge who happened to be a witness of fact and was not Jewish?
Well, again, what type of witness we're talking about? I think this comes back to Andy's point that they would accept the testimony of that person, but it wouldn't have the weight of a of the Shtei Edim. I don't see how it could from a halachic perspective.
You have a non-Jewish high court judge, right? Witness of fact,
yeah,
saying the exact opposite of a ne'er-do-well Jew.
No. So that's
he's
not
also a witness.
He's not a witness. No, but he's not.
But you've got two witnesses of fact.
Yeah.
They present themselves as witnesses of fact.
Correct. So which one would you follow? You'd follow the High Court judge.
Because
logic is telling you that this person's telling the truth and this one is not. That neither of them carries the weight of legal halachic testimony. Right. So neither of them is carrying that significance. That's.
But what the Gemara seems to be saying is a non-Jew cannot be.
No, so that's my point. It cannot be an aid. That's why I think maybe the word is getting us confused. Aiders in halacha is a very specific thing. When we're talking about shtei aidim, you have two halachic witnesses, which again, a ne'er-do-well Jew does not count as a halachic witness in any way, shape, or form, right? But when you have two upstanding, you know, halachic witnesses who have been cross-checked, etc., and have made a testimony, that testimony is taken very, very significantly. Okay, so that will contradict many other things, that will go against many other things. I'm not expert enough to necessarily go through all of what that might be, but that is the category that is this very high level category is the one that we're excluding from. But over here, I think to take Phil's, I think, good example, we're not dealing in the realm of Torah level testimony or whatever we're calling this category, right? This Shtei Edim category. We're dealing with a sense of whether this is what happened or didn't happen. And in that sense, you're gonna, as you say, you're gonna look at what the reality is in front of you. You know, what does it look like to you? What does it look like to us? Does this person seem to be telling us the truth? Is this someone we would generally trust? Is this a person who is
seems to be saying that you cannot cannot even hear the testimony.
I don't think so. No, I'm sure that's not the case.
Robert, I'm unclear as to the boundary of the nature of the thing that we can accept, that a base thing can accept,
right,
certain testimony. Because it seems to me you're saying that, you know, if it's got to be, we're looking at a situation where the witness has got to be aware of the significance of the testimony.
Yes. Okay. So I think that
the halakhic significance or the importance to the issue at hand.
Okay, so I think I'm going to try and clarify some of the elements for next time, but what I think the route that I will try and clarify, the route I'll try and clarify is, I think that when we're talking about testimony is a very high level. So, well, you guys can know better than me. When you have someone who stands up in court and takes an oath and says, this is what I believe, that's taken very seriously because they've taken an oath, right? That's my understanding.
Yeah, but I think one of the problems with our system,
it's so formal, yeah, that you don't necessarily believe someone who's happy.
You don't necessarily, who's under oath.
No,
okay, so that level. So I guess that's the point. Is I think that I think that's the difference. What exactly it means in practice, I don't know. But I think the difference is that when we're talking about two legal, kosher, full witnesses who are making a statement of fact, that is taken as fact, whereas other types of testimony, to use that word, are definitely admissible in court, but they're not taken as fact in quite the same way, and they're taken as guidelines more. I don't know. Maybe I'm using the wrong words. But as I say, I think we'll need to clarify some of the elements of this, and maybe come up with some practical examples of where it wouldn't apply and where it would apply, and how exactly it would work.
What I think you're saying though is that if you've got two aged under this concept, yeah, by honor would say they believe what they're saying, but it may not be the truth because they believe what they're saying. It may not be the factual accuracy because everyone sees things differently. And if someone comes along who's not Jewish and says, I was actually there, I was 2 feet away, and I actually saw what happened,
right,
that might carry greater weight than the aged who genuinely believe what they're saying, even if it may not be true.
Okay, I'm conscious of time, but I don't know. I'm gonna pause the recording here. So, I'll do it off the recording. But I don't understand.